From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in your hometown. Wherever you grew up, a question for you. Who founded your town and when? What were the political forces that played a role? Who benefited and who suffered? What's the story? Don't feel ashamed if you can't answer those questions. Most Americans can't. And that's just the beginning of the problem with local history and our lack of knowledge about it. So says SUNY Geneseo Distinguished Professor of History Michael Oberg. He's embarking on a mission of sorts. He wants to create a new Geneseo Center for Local Municipal History, an ambitious idea aimed at reviving our interest and stake in our own stories. And it won't be easy. Oberg points out that under New York State law, every municipality has to have an official historian. That comes out to one historian for each of the five boroughs of New York City, 12 community historians in Manhattan, 62 city historians around the state, 932 town historians, 544 village historians. Most are retirees who volunteer. Most are not paid. Most are white. And Oberg says most care very deeply, but they're facing a tall challenge, especially if they don't get much assistance from the academy. So he wants to form a partnership between local historians and SUNY Geneseo. He points out that the New York State K-12 social studies framework doesn't place any emphasis on local history. And the result is, well, many high school graduates who are largely illiterate when it comes to local history. Oberg writes, quote, many Americans, regardless of their political affiliation, feel disconnected, like outcasts, rootlessness. When we teach people about their own history, their own place, we teach them, at least in part, that their stories matter. So this weekend, Oberg is hosting a gathering at SUNY Geneseo to kick things off, and he's brought in a special guest to help energize the plan to engage with our own local histories. Our guests this hour include Michael Oberg, Distinguished Professor of History at SUNY Geneseo. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Evan.
And also with us is Taylor Sturmer, a nationally recognized historian, teaches public history at Johns Hopkins University, and the author of the forthcoming Public History, A Field Guide, among many other works. Taylor, welcome. Thanks for being here.
It's a pleasure, Evan. Thank you.
Michael, why don't you just give me a little bit of the background on how this idea, which you got a lot of work to do ahead of you here, how this came together in the first place.
It's every day I work on this, I'm aware of how much I have yet to learn about this history. Many years ago, when I first came to Geneseo in the late 1990s, some of my colleagues had a meeting where they invited local historians from Livingston County to come to campus. And I'd always kept that in mind as something that was very interested in doing. My own history is, the historical work I do is very locally focused. I do Native American history in this region. And I just reached out and became very curious about this and started meeting with local historians. And I was welcomed into the circle. And I realized that these local historians, and you didn't mention the county historians in that nice introduction, they're doing fantastic work. They are digitizing documents. They are making records available. They are making it possible for people across the state, across the country, across the world to do research on the history of local towns around the state. The work's being done, no matter what. But the academy has largely stayed aside from it or not been involved in any kind of formal way. So I felt this was a huge opportunity to get our students involved, to give our students some real-world experience, but also to allow our students to apply their expertise in ways that will complement what local historians do. Our students are learning how to digitize documents. They're learning how to use mapping programs and all kinds of stuff. The internet is going to be big, Evan. That's my prediction here. And they're just doing this incredible work. So I just feel like I want to get these students involved. The other thing is that not all history students want to become teachers, lawyers, or professors. They do all kinds of interesting things. And public history is a way for young people, public history and local history is a way for young people to quite literally rewrite history, make history, and produce a record of the past that will be consumed by huge numbers of people. And that's what all of us want, right? Whether we're local historians or county historians or people working in the museum business, we all want to educate, right? And that process of educating is what I think I would like to get Geneseo involved in. So we're going to have this gathering with about 85 people are coming to Geneseo, and we're going to talk about how best to do this and how best Geneseo can help.
When it comes to sort of the possible benefits and the risk of the status quo, one part I didn't read in the introduction was something that you wrote on your website that stood out to me. This isn't just a case of telling people, you know, largely students, but all of us, that our histories matter, our stories matter, because it makes us feel good or because, you know, a sense of place matters. You wrote about people being able to be a force in the history that's being shaped now. In other words, that understanding our own history, there are lessons that could be applied now and into the future beyond just, well, feel good, you know your history now. Tell me a little bit about that.
History, as I tell my students, is the study of continuity and change measured across time and space in people's institutions and cultures.
That's a good equation. I like that. Is that yours, by the way?
I think so. Yeah.
I'm going to steal it completely. I mean, it's fantastic. I can copyright that.
But I think what it seems to me, right, is that what we do is we ask why. That's what historians do. We ask how things came to be. Why are our communities the way they are? Why have towns developed in the way they have? Why do certain people live in certain places? Why are some people included? Why are some people excluded? Right, the different layers of history, how layers of history have been written or unwritten and erased from these stories. And I think by teaching people, and we're trying to reach out to kids and to college students and the general public, but teaching people that they have a role in their community, even if they're not told that they have a role in their community, even if they don't know what that role in the community is, that is empowering. That can get them engaged in the places in which they live. And I think across the board, right, civic engagement is so important. Informed citizenship. History is essential to informed citizenship.
Before I turn to Taylor, just one more quick note here. Before the program began, Michael relayed two stats that I'd love for you to remind us. The Simpsons versus the First Amendment, because this should horrify us.
It does. This is from a survey done about 10 years ago. And according to this survey, 20% of Americans, that's one in five, can identify all five members of the Simpson family. Yeah, Maggie, Marge, Bart, Lisa,
Homer.
Yeah. Thank you.
I got it.
Yeah. Well, and that's what runs through everyone's head. But less than 0.1% of Americans can identify all five freedoms in the First Amendment to the United States Constitution. Right. And that, if you do not know what those freedoms are, right, you may not know what you're losing, right? And in your line of work, press, freedom, assembly, petition, it's all there, right? So historical illiteracy has significant civic problems associated with it. And we hope to associate or to solve some of those problems, or at least address them.
Taylor, what do you make of the effort to bring the Academy together with historians who are, you know, I can't imagine being a volunteer historian in a town or municipality. I think it would be fascinating. I think I would love the work, but it's a challenge to contextualize, to understand it, and then to sort of stitch it together. And then you do that work and you've got to make people care. You got to figure out how does, you know, if a tree falls in the forest, that kind of a question. What do you make of the work that Michael's trying to do here?
I think Michael's doing some extraordinary stuff. This is a lot of heavy lifting that is not going on in many parts of America, much less parts of New York, in order to be able to make sure that we can, you know, we get into these words like leveraging resources. But this is true that for the most part, the town historians, the village historians, these folks, they're not paid. They don't really have much of a budget. They don't really have many resources to be able to connect with one another, much less connect with the university down the road. But also they're at cross purposes, if not living in two completely different worlds. You have academic historians who are developing theories and ideas based upon great movements and change and continuity over time. Great. But then you've got these local historians that are looking at the way that change and continuity has occurred just around the corner and trying to make those connections, as you said, in ways that matter. There is no more way that matters now than a battle against the way history is being weaponized. It's being used by people, particularly in public life, on all sides of the political spectrum, in order to convince people to do things that they wouldn't otherwise do or go along with things they wouldn't otherwise go along with, like, I don't know, declaring a national emergency, something like that, not understanding that there are constitutional arguments, there are historical arguments that are being hurled at people of all ages who don't have the shields to be able to respond to them and therefore understand how it fits into their own world and then the steps they need to be able to make the next one a better place because they can understand it and they can enter the argument.
Your forthcoming book is called Public History, A Field Guide. What's the mission that you set out when you wanted to write that book?
I wanted to tick off as many people in the museum world as possible, frankly. really. And that seems to be what I'm good at. So I'm going to go with that as my mission statement. But mainly it's about... It is about this division between academic history and the folks who are doing history on the ground, the public historians who are practicing it on the ground, that it is a way to try to shift the discussion from all the different kind of folks who produce history, whether you walk around wearing funny clothes at a museum talking to people, which is extraordinarily valuable and popular, or whether it is in standing in front of a 400-person lecture hall and talking about Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings. I mean, that's valuable too. But that is not the way people consume history. That is not the way people get their history. Most people consume their history through movies, through TV shows, both fictional and nonfiction. They're doing it through through Outlander. They're doing it through the movies that they go see. They're doing it through what they just hear on TV and what they hear spouted from public figures. So we have to go to where they are on this, you know, crazy internet thing that the kids are all excited about. We need to go to where they are and see how they are consuming the history and then work from there in terms of the kind of questions they are asking, instead of the ones that we really want them to be able to answer, whether or not they know that the Constitution, you know, 1787, great. But do they know what the Constitution means? Yeah. Do they know what it means to them? Do they know what the history of it is in their community?
So this is a question that's a little tangential, but I'm going to try to tie it together, and I hope you'll indulge it. Because when you make the point, Taylor, that people are going to consume history in various ways, sometimes it's through the media they consume, and sometimes it's through movies they watch or
video games.
Or video games, or all kinds of things. And without either filling in the gaps or offering really good instruction, information, education in different settings, they may be taking ideas and assuming that this is accurate or this is correct or this is properly contextualized. So I just sort of selfishly wonder, when you see biopics, do you think, don't tell me, director and scriptwriters, that you took a little license here, because most of the people who saw Lincoln didn't study the way this amendment came together. I need you to be accurate. Do those kind of drive you nuts, or do you think, hey, at least you're getting people to engage with the subject?
I am right in the middle of that, because that's the one thing you run into all the time, is that, well, I don't mind that they completely got William Wallace wrong in Braveheart. It got people interested in the subject, and that's really what our goal is. No, it's not. this is the problem that town historians have, that local historians have, that a lot of academic historians don't necessarily have. It's all of the undoing of parts of history that people are getting wrong and the things that they're acting on it. And so when you have all that remedial work to do to fix what people have gotten wrong, whether it's in a biopic. I mean, you can be really lucky and have a biopic like, you know, Mary Queen of Scots or something like that, or The Favourite, which is a wonderful, probably the most accurate historical film in the last 25 years. Extraordinary.
The Favourite?
The Favourite, which is up for a couple of Oscars. It's just terrific.
Wow.
Yeah, it's amazing. It makes Queen Anne, for the first time, interesting. because it's real. It's the true story. So you can sort of go through that. But getting back to your point, that on the one side, it can't just be, well, it's going to generate interest in a subject. Because people are going to then go, if they do, they are then going to go get it from Wikipedia, which, give me 5 minutes and I'll change that to something that I want you to know. They're not going to go at all, versus you've got to go ahead and make sure that every button on somebody's coat, on Daniel Day-Lewis's coat in Lincoln, is absolutely accurate. Who cares? Is he getting Lincoln right? Is he getting the period right? Is he getting the essence? Mm-hmm. There are some problems with the way it talks about how the amendment got passed. But was Lincoln a complicated guy? Yeah. Was he facing forces that are unexpectedly problematic? Absolutely. Do you get that impression from the movie? Absolutely. Do you know it was a long slog and it was a difficult thing and it was completely opposed at the time rather than something everybody embraced? That's important. In other words, is the essence of the story authentic and true and relatable? If you get those things, then whether or not he's wearing the right buttons doesn't matter to me.
We're going to do Braveheart on a whole separate hour, just dissecting Braveheart. How do you feel about this question?
Well, you know, I'm not – no one will watch historical movies with me in my house.
You're insufferable,
right?
Right.
But I think one of the things that I would one of the problems I have with biopics and all this is that it's an elite history too often. Yeah. And one of the things that's fascinating, we just came from the Rochester Historical Society, the records they have in their collections, and some of the local historians, local town historians' offices and county historians' offices I've worked at, is they have the records to really recreate the lives of you know, quote unquote, ordinary people. And these lives are significant, right? And there's an exercise I always ask my students, like, what's the most important event that's happened in your life? And they struggle because they're young, right? And they'll say, well, 9/11 or the election of Barack Obama or something like that. They'll struggle and like, well, what's the most important event in your life? I just ask them a question again. Is it the divorce of your parents or the death of a grandparent? Or what is the event that made you who and what you are? What is the event after which nothing in your life was ever the same? Those are the events that are significant, right? So long historians have had these exams where we say, identify and give the significance of, you know, the Smoot-Hawley tariff or something like that. And frankly, you know, following Taylor's point, you can live a rich and meaningful life without knowing what the hell the Smoot-Hawley tariff is, you know? And it's just, you know, but if we look at ordinary lives and how people dealt with success and loss and grief and happiness and these ordinary lives, you can learn a lot. If you look at how your neighbors in the past dealt with injustice or adversity or how they confronted the questions that afflicted their communities, that is incredibly meaningful. And I've been teaching for 25 years now, and those are the lessons that, boom, I got students paying attention to those ordinary stories. And I think that's really the power of what these local collections and these local archives have. And I'll just give you one quick example,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, please.
There's this, in the early 1900s, all of federal Indian policy and all of New York Indian policy was directed towards basically the eradication of Native nations and Native culture. There's this fantastic photographic collection, almost all of which has been digitized at the Rochester Museum and Science Center. It's news photos from Rochester, and there's a series of photos from 1911, 1912, of Tonawanda Senecas coming into Rochester in 1912. They're supposed to be disappearing. They're not supposed to be here. They're coming into Rochester wearing traditional dress, like gastoa and ribbon shirts. They sell baskets and brooms and handicrafts. They hold dances, and they adopt the mayor, Hiram Edgerton, as a member of the nation, right? They're supposed to be gone, but there they are, marching in traditional dress, saying, look, folks, we're still here. You can try to eradicate us, but we're gone. That took place in Maplewood Park, right?
Maplewood Park.
Yeah, right? You know, spitting distance, right? And that's not a history that we learn, right? And there are these layers of history on these sites all around us. And look, history is not this thing that just falls out of the sky. We make choices. Taylor makes choices. I make choices. We make choices about the stories we can tell. And one of the things I certainly try to encourage my students this, and local historians do this all the time, is we can choose different stories. We can ask anything we want, right? That's the great thing about historians. We do the grunt work for all the social sciences. We can do whatever we want, right? We can ask any question we want, every question about what happened, any question about continuity and change. That's a historical question that historians can answer, and there are so many cool things in these archives, in these little town halls. There's amazing material to answer these questions.
You happen to choose an example of a story that roughly when did that happen?
1912.
1912. That, you know, now with a child in the first grade, I continually stress the point that I've got a lot of love and respect for his teachers. Public school teachers, they're really doing tremendous work. But I'm very keen on seeing, what are you learning about Native Americans, Native peoples? And it's amazing how many kids his age, understandably so, they're repeating what they've been taught is, well, they'll say things like, quote, the Indians lived a long time ago.
Yeah.
And you and I have talked about this. You just chose an example that's more than 100 years old, but is so stark as a way of saying, you can try to eradicate us. We're here. We're still here. And that's still here. There are brothers and sisters today still here.
Yes.
But a lot of kids are growing up with the idea. And if you gave them that local history, that might imprint on them right away. They've continually fought against, number one, the desire to actually physically eradicate them, the dispossession that's occurred, and then just the erasure that happens in communities.
Yeah.
That one story.
Right.
That's a powerful local story.
There are so many stories like this. Every time I meet people, I've had colleagues who send students out to the graveyards to look at the consequences of the flu epidemic in the early 20th century. The Livingston County historian is doing this amazing work digitizing poorhouse records, which is a snapshot into people who only arrive in the historical record because they're suffering, right? Because they're in the lowest of the possible low points. These are people who would be invisible, right? They would not be part of the historical record. So by doing this sort of history and taking advantage of these local records, we're democratizing the story of history, but also tying it into people's lives. And that's what's so cool about it.
Taylor, what do you make of hearing these stories? There's probably so many that may come to mind as well.
Well, and the kind of work that Michael does is so, so relevant and revealing about how important these stories are. I firmly believe that if we were able to get together and put maybe like a 10-year moratorium on any book or movie about George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, and Benjamin Franklin, or anybody who can possibly be referred to as a founder, and then just stop that, make it illegal for 10 years, and then have historians work on the people who we've forgotten over the last 100 years, and then come back to it and let's see what history looks like. Let's see the history of African Americans and of Native Americans and of women. One of the great examples at this wonderful time that we had at the Rochester Historical Society this morning that speaks to things that are going on today, speaks to Me Too, it speaks to political activism, were just a couple of letters that they have in an autograph collection that's in a corner. But those two letters were written, one in 1899 and the other one in 1902, by Mary, the sister of Susan B. Anthony. And one of them was a protest letter for sending in her taxes. And so she's sending in this letter where she's describing how men, even the most drunk man,
drunk and debased
man, can still be allowed to vote. And she, who will pay a large measure of her taxes, will not be allowed to do those. So therefore, she is sending along her check for taxes under protest.
Under protest.
But then there's another letter in there that is, I think, just as revealing it to me, one of these stories that can connect the local, what's going on right around the corner, to the macro. And connected to what's going on today. And that was a letter she wrote in 1899 to somebody who had written in the local Rochester paper a letter to the editor opposing women's involvement in school boards. And she wrote to him, inviting him to the next talk being given by her sister. We feel that you oppose a lot of what we stand for in terms of women and as political activists. And it's written on the letterhead of the Rochester Political Equality Club. And she invites him, saying, please bring your arguments. Share with us your arguments. Post your arguments. And we will see what we can do to have a civic discussion about them. And by the way, P.S., if you can't come, can you just send them in writing? To be able to, and you know, there are not a lot of books written about Mary, but this one letter wants to invite the debate. Wants to engage the opponents, wants to make sure that it's informed, not just having a paper war. To me, it was, I think we saw many interesting things. To me, that was probably the most evocative.
And that was around 1900?
It was 1899.
1899. Yeah. I mean, think of what history teachers, I mean, beyond historians who, again, this new center, which in our second half hour, we'll talk more about how maybe Michael's vision of how it could function are going to work with. But think if you're just a school teacher, because we mentioned at the outset here, K-12 New York State standards doesn't mandate teaching any local history.
Yeah, they do New York history, I think, in fourth grade, I believe. Maybe someone can clarify that. But, you know, and look, teachers are strapped in terms of the burdens, you know, they're first responders in terms of taking care of children and all that. It's a huge job, and a thankless job. So it's hard to do everything they do. And that's one of the things ultimately I'd like to look forward to doing is lesson plans and unit plans that tie the local story into the larger story, the local stories that illustrate larger themes that are present in the learning outcomes, social standards, social studies standards that the state does have. So we can tie the local story into the larger and connect people. And again, show them that your story matters, right? That your family exemplifies some of these larger themes we're talking about. The Rochester Citizenship, what was a club called? I don't know that club existed. I knew nothing about this, right? But I'll bet you.
careful.
I'm going to send a student into the public library and to do some research on this club because I want to know more about it. Absolutely. And I think that there's a lot of big questions that the presence of this club.
And we wanted to know whether or not the guy she invited actually went.
Yeah, exactly. We got to go check the newspaper.
I don't know how this ends. Yeah,
exactly.
I don't know how this story ends.
Because the best part of this stuff is that it's a question that leads to a story that is an important one, and we want to know how it ends.
We want to know how it ends, and then we can imagine why it still matters now. We imagine why it made such an impact, but also what's undone today. Mm-hmm. Where are the echoes today? Where do we find sort of the lack of inclusion or opportunity or injustices today? What might a letter today look like if it was written in the same sort of spirit? Oh my gosh, there's so much teachers could do with that. I just find it, I love that. I love that kind of storytelling because ultimately, people even ask on this program, as your show script, I said you can't put a script for an hour together. But the only part of the script of the show is the opening. And that's because I believe that people fundamentally want to hear stories. So we try to tell a story that instantly tells you why we're here for the hour. That's the only part of the script that there is here, because people want to hear stories. And not just because it's enjoyable, and it is, but because you want to understand why it matters. That's why I think what Michael Oberg is doing at SUNY Geneseo matters. Taylor Sturmer is with us, a nationally recognized historian and author of the forthcoming Public History, A Field Guide. So why don't we take our only break of the hour? We're going to come back. And listeners, if you've got feedback about your thoughts on what we do and don't know about our own history, particularly local histories, and what you think the consequences of that are, you can share your thoughts with us, connections@wxxi.org, if you want to reach out. And we're going to talk about how this center may come together and what Michael, if whether he's bitten off more than he can chew here. So we'll talk about that in our second half hour after the only break on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on the next Connections, we have special rebroadcasts for you on President's Day. In our first hour, a conversation about how to have civil discussion with people who don't share our views. We'll talk about how to engage and listen and maybe get out of our own bubbles. Then in our second hour, a mural project highlights the stories of five local women. It's called Her Voice Carries, and it's the subject of a documentary premiering on WXXI-TV on March 1st. Talk with you Monday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Before we continue, I want to inject an important point here that I think shouldn't be missed, which is that you've got more than 1,500 historians across New York State, most of them volunteer, most unpaid. Here's a note from one of them on Twitter. Mike reaches out to us to say, as the town historian, I am the only non-paid employee. I don't spend a lot of time doing my job. I mean, you hear story after story, town after town, village after village. And this is not at all to condemn the people who are doing this work. Yeah. But the reality is, I have to assume the vast majority are older and white. And, again, one individual in one town, if that person happens to be white, it doesn't mean that they can't do the job. But I think collectively, I would ask you, Michael, especially given the work that you've done over the author of Native America History, very, very much attuned to how we may teach or change or alter or sort of kind of mold history in certain ways. Eventually, do we need to find a way to create a more diverse field of historians?
Yes. Yes. I'm not sure how that's done. I'm still learning about the appointment of local historians. Sure. And things like that. But I think certainly we need more diversity in the field, and I would love to have it. And one way to get more diversity is to pay people to do it. And, we always lament the lack of money. I do think there's some civic value in history, and it's good for all of us as a community to do that. That said, what we do as historians is ask questions. Right. That's what we do, and we answer them in a systematic and disciplined manner. We look at the evidence and we try to see what's out there and figure out what's going on. And anyone can do that, right? The questions you ask may be conditioned by who you are and your background, and I think that's important to have different questions asked by different sorts of people. I think that's very, very valuable. It's essential for the discipline, but we can all do this. And I do think that all of us, right? We're always reassessing the questions we ask. We're always asking, is this the right question? Are there better questions? Should we be asking other questions? And I think that applies for academic history. It applies for the popular history, you know, the founder's chic kind of stuff that's going on. But also what's going on at the local level. And it's kind of questions we ask our children to answer in the elementary schools. There's a lot of changes we can do. And I think talking about it is an essential first step, and that's one of the things I hope we'll accomplish on Saturday. Have I, you know, you mentioned before the break, have I bitten off more than I can chew? Yes, I absolutely have, and I think that's okay. I think it's good to jump into this, and what I'm hopeful to accomplish as we move this forward is to create a situation where I can place our students in partnerships with local historians. They can help local historians do this really important, cool work they're doing. They can bring the perspectives they're learning in the classroom, right? New perspectives and so on and so forth. And then they can learn the craft, right? And like I said, so many local historians are doing fantastic work, right? The Wayne County historians are amazing, right? The huge contingent of Wayne County historians are coming to my gathering, this gathering at Geneseo. They're just doing fantastic work, digitizing records. That allow us to answer all sorts of questions.
Right? And raise new ones.
And raise new ones, absolutely, and raise new ones. And I think that's what's so exciting about this work. And, you know, I'll talk with, you know, we were like just a Rochester Squirrel Society, and it's like, oh my God, you have this stuff. It's just, you can keep asking questions. And the archives are full of material for telling stories that are more representative of the diversity of our community. We can choose to ask those questions we want. I think we absolutely should, especially if our purpose is to reach out to children, reach out to communities, and educate the public.
Sometimes the limits of local history people get, and we mentioned this during our brief break, are those blue and gold signs that you see. And I know Taylor has something to say about. Was there a project that you were talking about?
Well, with my students, the first thing that I have them do for one of my classes is because historical markers really is probably the most ubiquitous form of public history.
True.
That everybody's familiar with. This is history that is quite literally etched in iron, and it comes with this air of. This air of authority, and people accept that, okay, well, whatever it says, that X person, usually X white person, did something that was great for white people here on this spot that we should now revere in the history of a whole bunch of white people. So what I do with my students, just as a way to get them to start thinking about history as being a work in progress rather than something that is just set of information that you need to memorize, is for them to, in their community, pick a historical marker that needs to go away, that is a part of history that is either no longer relevant to our current conversation. Again, it's part of that, what are we teaching and what do we know that frankly is interesting, but it's not important. It is not something that's going to impact their lives. So first, what would you erase? What would you take away? And second, okay, what is the marker that needs to go up, that is not represented? What is the marker about LGBTQ history that needs to be up because that is a part of our community? What is the marker about African American history that needs to go up? That is a part of the country we are, the country we are becoming, and the conversation we therefore need to have. And so.
Such an interesting question.
But mm-hmm. To me, that gets to the heart of one of, if we're going to make this hour a story. We've gone through exposition. Let's get into conflict. Where all of the municipal historians, their contribution is, I would just say, it's kaleidoscopic in terms of their level of contribution to the kind of mission that Michael's talking about. That there are some who aren't doing much at all. There are some who are doing it. Obviously, a lot of it has to do with resources. That the one way that we can do this is to make sure they get paid. Almost none of them do. But the other part is, what is there any kind of guidance that can be provided that is the kind of thing Michael has in mind for this center, is that it's not just about sharing resources. It's also about sharing visions. What really should be the role of these folks on the ground, in the towns, in the villages, in the municipalities, in the counties? Is there a bigger vision that they should be pursuing that gets into making sure they're shaping a better body politic?
Now I want to go out and read all of those signs and markers and start thinking about what maybe is obviously either inaccurate or skewed. Mm-hmm. What should maybe come down? What are we missing? That's mm-hmm. such an interesting question. And you can literally do it town by town and village by village and even in places neighborhood by neighborhood. And Michael Oberg, you wouldn't be doing this. Let's talk about what you're going to end up doing here if this works here. But before we even do it, to kind of reset for the listeners, Michael's a distinguished professor of history at SUNY Geneseo. He's brought in Taylor Sturmer, our guest here, the author of the forthcoming Public History of Field Guide, who has taught at a number of places now, including Johns Hopkins. And you've got a big day tomorrow where you've got, you know, more than 80 people. You've got historians. You want to work with the historians in the academy because, as you see it, there is a disconnect. And part of that disconnect results in more Americans growing up without much knowledge about their local history, which must come at a cost. What is the cost to the status quo? What is the cost of people literally growing up, no K through 12 emphasis on local histories, graduating and going off into the world without much knowledge of local history?
Well, I think the stuff I wrote that you read in the introduction is the cost, is a lack of connection to place. If we want to make our communities better places, if we want to fix our communities, it helps to be rooted to that community and tied to its story. There are people who feel excluded, marginalized, disfranchised in their communities, yet they are central to it, and their stories and how they got to that community are central to that story. So if we want to empower people, encourage people to look at the complexity of the problems that are in front of us, let's show them the story of those problems, right? And I just think it's amazing the depth of problems. We have schools in receivership in the city school district where children in those schools are taught, you know, my really great teachers, but they don't have the resources to focus on the local history. What is the neighborhood? What is the story of the neighborhood from which these kids came? Why do people? Why has Rochester developed in the way it has? Right, a while back this was the center of Rochester where we're sitting today, you know, around High Falls. Right, but now it's shifted, and then it's shifting out to the suburbs. Why is Rochester shaped the way it is? Why was there an inner loop for many years? And by teaching these stories, we connect these people. And it just seems to me that the costs of historical illiteracy and certainly civic illiteracy are extraordinary, right? If you don't know what the Constitution says, for example, and how the Constitution came to be, man, you are a fit tool for a tyrant. And as much as I really despise Thomas Jefferson in so many ways, at a deep and visceral level, he really, the founding generation emphasized the importance of an informed citizenry, right? Now, they had a very truncated version of what a citizen was, but that if you don't have people who are civically engaged, civically informed, civically involved, and history is a big part of that, Jefferson emphasized the study of history, you've got fit tools for tyrants.
And this is the key part to where we are today in terms of American public life. That a republic, and the kind of republic that the founders wanted to create, and let's just do our bit of a contribution to founder chic here, that the kind of republic that they had in mind, that folks like little James Madison had in mind, it demands informed citizenship, and not just through freedom of speech and expression, but it demands an understanding of historical precedent. It doesn't an understanding of where you came from in order to understand, and this can be a pat term, but it happens to be a pat term that matters, to understand where you're going. And that is critical to a republic. A republic of engaged citizens who understand their responsibilities, understand their roles, and therefore can exercise them and have these shields against tyrants. I mean, what Michael just said, I think, is one of the greatest. I'm just going to have that etched into marble somewhere.
Well, I don't want to be too gloomy either. I mean, a lot of local history, a lot of historians do their work because it's fun. We enjoy what we do. It's immensely rewarding, right? And you know, so I feel like I need to brighten things up a little bit, right? We were awfully gloomy there for a minute.
I like to fight. Come on.
I'm scribbling down for a future conversation. Thomas Jefferson, Michael Oberg, not a fan.
Yeah, my students will like that. It's gotten around that I dislike them. But look, you know, I mean, I'll give you one little quick local story, right? And my neighbor, who's a geographer at Geneseo, who knows local history backwards and forward, he goes, you know, we just moved. We bought this house. My wife and I just bought this house. There's something about that house. You got to go look into it. There's some history. It's like, okay, fine. I go to the town historian's office, and she goes, yeah. That house was designed by the first black architect in Rochester. I'm like, wow, that's awesome. And she found the builder's permit from 1950. Go, that's pretty cool. And then so I poke around. I do some little research, and I find out, well, the blueprints are at the Museum and Science Center, the blueprints for this house. And just like, you know, it's like I'm triangulating off these different sources, and it's just so much fun, right? You learn these great stories, and I think by getting kids, you know, again, we don't need to teach kids the Smoot-Hawley Tariff or, you know, the Civilian Conservation Corps was pretty cool, but there's a lot of teaching that's rote, right? And you see that with your kids, and I don't think that's the way to do it. I think the way to gauge it, how much fun this is, right? Learning about who you are, where you are, and why you are. Where you are is the power of a lot of civics education.
All right, in a moment, how they're going to try to do this, but let me grab a phone call. This is Ted in Rochester. Go ahead, Ted.
Hey, Evan. Exciting show. My head is whirring. Thank you, everyone, for your insightful commentary. So I'm a local activist, and I've been pushing for a police accountability board here in town. And about 5-6 years ago, I actually did a research project at the local history section of the Rochester Library, and I'm an activist, so I want to see things change. I want to see things get better for everyone, not just for individuals or for personal self-interest. And I was at some anti-police brutality rallies in the mid-2000s, around 2010, and people kept referencing Rochester's first civilian review board from 1963, and I could never get any other details about it. So I decided to go down to the local history section, and I did a 500-word or a 500-article content analysis of newspaper clippings from the Democrat and Chronicle of the Times Union from 1963 to 1970, and unearthed this amazing convulsion of social action in Rochester that I had only heard whispers of at protests, and now I have like a much more fundamental understanding of what happened, and that has helped guide sort of me going forward in this effort to pass the Police Accountability Board Rochester, New York in 2019. And that, what was interesting about this board in 63 was it didn't have disciplinary power, but if the chief and the board disagreed, and the chief refused to, or the, excuse me, the public commissioner, the police commissioner, refused to implement the discipline recommended by the board, they could have a public hearing and let loose all the information they have: names, dates, places, times, events, etc. And the unions were very upset about this across the state, you know, locally, and they locally rather, and the locust club actually filed a lawsuit against the police advisory board after it was passed in 63, 2 years later, and that injunction stopped it from doing its work for about, you know, six, seven years. But eventually what happened was the legislation went to the New York State Court of Appeals, and then the police union asked the New York, United States Supreme Court to grant certiorari to review it, and they refused, and then went back down, and the whole law was unconstitutional. Well, in 1970, Rochester becomes a strong mayor town. Stephen Macomb's into power, and suddenly the PAB of 1963 is completely abolished. And that same year, in 1970, there are in the newspapers again and again and again instances of like what appear to be police overreaction and brutality, and people calling for the PAB to be reestablished, and politicians not doing anything. And now in 2019, I don't know what year I'm in anymore, you know, here we are in 2019, the city council actually put into a legislation that is potentially stronger than what they had in 63, but offers the same kinds of safeguards for the community that were potentially there in 1963. So it's just, I guess I'm an amateur historian and I love history, but I love it in the sense of, how does it carry me to a place where we can actually make change so I can look forward moving forward, I guess.
Ted, thank you. I suspect this is what Professor Oberg, exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, thank you for that call, Ted, because that is such an important point, and it's something I neglected to mention earlier. Is that a former student contacted me a while back and said, you know, it's not just local municipal historian. There are all kinds of activist organizations and nonprofits who have histories and institutional records and telling these stories is important as well, and it leads to the same kind of work that Ted did. And you know, don't sell yourself short as an amateur historian, right? We're all amateurs when we start off on a project, and we just start digging and digging. But this is exactly the kind of work I want to have students do. So the way things, you know, we're going to talk and learn a lot this Saturday, and Taylor speaking is our keynote address. We're having a panel discussion, which will feature Michelle Finn, who's a deputy city historian, works at the Rochester Public Library, Devin Lander, who is the New York State historian, a local historian from Brighton, Mary Jo Lamphere, and a student, one of our students who's done an internship. And I'm expecting to learn as much as I learn from every conversation I have with these folks. And then the first summer session, right after graduation, we'll be teaching a class called Local History Workshop, which is, I wish I had a better title for the class, but I'll work with that. And the idea is that I'm going to send students out to pair up with local historians and local historical organizations and societies around the state, right? So they will meet and we'll talk and we'll go through the kind of material in, you know, just sort of the state-of-the-art kind of stuff. But then I will turn them loose and send them where they will go home for the summer, and they will work in historical organizations in their local community. I'm hoping to, you know, a lot of this depends on the students, so I hope this will be sustainable and that we will be putting our students out in internships where they do precisely some of the stuff that Ted did in this call, where history affects change, right? History's not trivia, right? That's not what we do. There's a purpose to studying this, for informed civic engagement.
And, you know, sometimes people hear, oh, you want to create the Geneseo Center for Local Municipal History. They envision it this big building with the big sign, and when does it open, and you're going to do a ribbon cutting. It sounds like it's sort of rolling out on its own, one way or another.
My office building is going to be renovated, so I'm going to be completely. I don't know where I will be next semester, but I'll be on campus somewhere. I encourage anyone who's interested, anyone who has an organization or society, just you can find my email address on the Geneseo webpage.
I want to read an email on this. Catherine says, "Is this open to only historians or other historic organizations who don't necessarily have an official historian position? And how does one contact you?"
My last name is Oberg, O-B-E-R-G, and you can reach me at oberg@geneseo.edu. And Catherine, please drop me a line, and I'll be in touch.
So you don't have to. It's not just for historians, in other words.
Yeah. Well, this gathering, I'm at capacity for tomorrow in terms of what we have room for. But Catherine, we're going to do more of these down the road. I'm hopeful about that, and certainly I will make sure you are on the invitation list for future gatherings and future events.
Okay, and I guess I'm going to like write a story for WXXI News that says your center opens tomorrow, but it doesn't. Does it?
It's already open. It's
a thing. Is it a
center?
Yeah,
it's
it's informally launching.
Yes, that's what it's doing. We are meeting tomorrow, and we're getting started. This is our first big step, and I was shocked by the enthusiasm and the amount of responses. More people have expressed interest in coming than I can hold. And it's just very humbling that, this many people are interested in, local history. So I'm really looking forward to, getting to work on this.
Last quick one from that historian who wrote in earlier. Mike says, school teachers are no longer local and don't teach local history as, they used to in fourth grade. Young folks don't have attachment to small villages as they never saw it like old folks did with active downtowns. It's all about memories. That's from Mike. Some final thoughts there. Is that school teachers not being local? I don't know. I mean, I'd love to explore more of his point there. But can we connect this to classrooms? Can you connect this to fourth grade? Can you find different ways to connect what your work is about to set out here?
I had a student who approached me last week who said she didn't want to do like an internship in terms of, because she wasn't interested in museum studies or public history as a field, but she wanted to be an elementary school teacher. And so she asked, could I do an internship where I worked in a local historian's office and in my town and put together a course packet that the teacher could use to teach the learning outcomes on fourth grade? And I was like, yeah, absolutely, right? That's awesome. So I think it's essential to tie it in.
Well, I want to thank our guests for being here. And Taylor Sturmer, if you read his Twitter page, I thought for a second he might not be here based on the travails of travel, but he's here. Taylor Sturmer is a nationally recognized historian and the author of the forthcoming Public History, A Field Guide. Thank you for being here. I know the historians will appreciate it tomorrow, and our listeners did today as well. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Michael Oberg, Distinguished Professor of History at SUNY Geneseo. Good luck with the center. Good luck finding an office. And keep us abreast of what's happening. Thank you.
Thank you, Evan.
Our thanks to Rob Braden, engineer, Megan Mack, producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a wonderful weekend. And we're back with you next week on member-supported public radio.